Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Melody Barnes, and I am the director of the Domestic Policy Council, and it is a pleasure to be with you this morning. Before we go any further, I do want to thank Shannon again for her really exemplary presentation, for sharing that information with all of us. So thank you so much, Shannon. We really appreciate it. I'm going to introduce the members of the panel in just a moment, but before I begin, and this isn't me being rude, my watch band broke, so this is my watch to keep up with time. Before I begin, I just want to say a couple of things before we start our conversation and before we engage in a conversation with you. The first of that is, and I was thinking about this as I was talking to Jeff and talking to Greg about this morning, the fact that we are 30 years into the epidemic of HIV/AIDS. And that immediately took me back to, you know, being in high school and early years of college and the conversations and what it meant and what it felt like to have these conversations during that time period. And it also really underscores the fact that 30 years into this epidemic, we cannot believe, we cannot expect that there's going to be a single earth-shattering response, kind of a silver bullet, so to speak, to resolving and addressing this particular issue. That isn't going to be our ticket to progress as we try to address the issues surrounding HIV/AIDS. But instead, it requires us to take a long, steady, hard, critical look at this issue, at the problem, and all the things that we've done thus far, the things that have gone well, the things that have not, and to do a careful assessment and determine how we should move forward. That also means for us that we have to engage in conversation, something that Jeff, and you know, I say this, I feel comfortable in saying this, having Jeff work in the Domestic Policy Council and run the Office of National AIDS Policy, something I think Jeff and his team have done an exemplary job of, which is engaging with people around the country and indeed outside of the continental United States to talk about this people and engaging with you. Committed people, people who bring a lot of expertise to this topic, to talk about what we have done. And it's certainly part of the command that the President has given us. Think critically, think analytically, let's look at this issue in a very, very smart way. So that's why this conversation is so important to us. It also means that we have to think in a very smart way about how we can make progress with regard to HIV for all Americans, but the facts tell us that we have to also think about what this means very specifically for the African-American community and also specifically with regard to gay and straight African-American men, which obviously is the reason that we've asked you all to join us for this conversation this morning and the purpose of the conversation and having the experts with me on this panel to initiate the conversation and then to engage with you. And we hope that you, as you've worked with us over the course of the last year and a half, and certainly as we work together in the months and years to come, believe that this kind of a theme meeting, as well as all of the meetings that we've done and will continue to do, are an indication of our commitment, in fact, the President's commitment to this issue. And as we begin to roll out the National AIDS Strategy, that you will continue to work with us because we are indeed committed to the main pillars of our National AIDS Strategy. So with that, I'd like to introduce the members of the panel, and then I'll ask them a few questions and hope that we can start a conversation here, and then we want to broaden it and spend some time having a conversation with you. So first I want to introduce Dr. Garth Graham, and Garth is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Minority Health in the Office of Minority Health at the Department of Health and Human Services. He founded the Boston Men's Cardiovascular Health Project and is currently on the faculty of Harvard Medical School while also serving as a visiting scientist at the Harvard School of Public Health. And I was saying, as I was thinking through the introductions yesterday, you know, you get up in the morning, you think you're doing pretty well, you know, your parents should be proud of you, and then you start reading the bios of people like that. It's like, you know, in his spare time, Garth solved world peace or something like that. But I think all of the members of our panel are like that. Sitting next to Garth is Dr. Kevin Fenton, who's the director of the National Center for HIV/AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention, at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC. And prior to his work at the CDC, Dr. Fenton was the director of HIV Sexually Transmitted Infections Department in the United Kingdom's Health Protection Agency. Dr. Deborah Parham Hobson is the Associate Administrator for HIV/AIDS in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration, or because we have to shorten everything in the federal government, HRSA. HRSA works to fill in the healthcare gaps for people who live outside the economic and medical mainstream. And finally, seated next to me is Dr. Newton Kendig, who is Assistant Director for the Health Services Division of the and Medical Director for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Dr. Kendig is also a part-time faculty member focusing on infectious diseases at Johns Hopkins University. Please join me in welcoming the members of our panel. So, Dr. Fenton, Kevin, I'd like to start with you and just ask you, why are infection rates disproportionately higher among black men?
So thank you very much. And again, good morning, everyone. It really is a pleasure to be here and an honor to be here. And from a personal perspective as a black male, this means a lot to be here for us to be having this conversation this morning. I think we heard quite a bit from Greg, as well as from Shannon this morning, as to why we're seeing these high rates of infection among black men. And as there's no single magic bullet for the cure for HIV, there's no single response to explain why we're seeing these high rates. There are a multiplicity of factors. We know that there are no essential differences in risk behaviors, so we need to look beyond behaviors. And we believe that there are four key drivers for the higher rates. First is the higher background prevalence of disease within the population, and you heard that eloquently explained at the local level by Shannon and also at the national level by Greg. So the higher prevalence of disease means that there's a greater force of infection. In other words, your probability of becoming infected with HIV is much higher with a single episode of unprotected sex, simply because there are more people with HIV around you. We also need to think about some of the cofactors for HIV transmissions, the factors which facilitate HIV. And we know that in the black community, there are higher rates, for example, of sexually transmitted diseases. And STDs can facilitate your both acquisition of HIV as well as the transmission of HIV between 2- and 6-fold. So again, if you have an STI on board, it means you're at much greater risk of becoming HIV infected. And we know that in the black community, we're seeing higher rates of chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, and viral sexually transmitted infections. And CDC recently released a report highlighting the higher rates of herpes simplex infection among the black community. The other major cofactor that we're dealing with in the black community is what I term the social determinants of health, the factors which really create the context for either higher rates of risk behaviors or can facilitate the spread of disease. You heard this morning about the higher incarceration rates among the black community. We know that socioeconomic deprivation is certainly an issue for our community. We know that there are issues related to stigma and discrimination within the community and homophobia. These are some of the social determinants or social factors which create the environment which facilitates the spread of HIV. So I've only picked out three major factors there, and there are many more that I'm sure we'll discuss this morning. But just to get the conversation started, there is no single reason why we're seeing these higher rates of infections among the black community or within black men. We need to look at multiplicity of factors which are all interacting with each other.
Great, thank you. And I wanted to start with that question. I think Shannon's talk with us left us with or raised this issue of stigma. And people ask that question, and I think it's important that we have data and evidence-based information that helps explain it to people in the way that you did. I want to go next to Dr. Parham. Given the need, can you talk to us about why or the main issues that HIV-positive black men have trouble accessing the care that they need?
Thank you for that question. Before I answer, I just want to say that I'm talking from the perspective as the director of the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program. That's a program that does provide care and treatment to 500,000 people living with HIV, many of whom are African American. In fact, about 72% of our clients report that they are racial or ethnic minorities. And we know that of the people that we see in our programs, that there are black men who are enrolled in care. But as Dr. Hayter mentioned this morning, there are so many that are not in care. And so we took a look at that to figure out why people were not in care, and we came up with a number of reasons. There are healthcare system structural barriers, care that's not available in various communities, which limits the availability of services. The clinics may not be in convenient areas, or they may not have convenient hours. If you're working from 9 to 5 and the clinic is open from 9 to 5, then when are you supposed to go and get your care? Once you do get in care, there may be poor provider-patient communication. And when you can't understand what your provider is saying to you, you're not likely to stay in care. And then we have the issue of retention. If you can't understand your provider, the clinic, you work really hard to get there for a clinic that may not have hours that are convenient or be in a convenient location, then why do you make the effort to come back? And so you get lost to care. And so that's one of the challenges that we have. There are also competing needs that people have. Housing, food, transportation, these are all issues that people face on a daily basis. Getting into care for HIV, when you kind of look good, you feel good. There are other things that you need to address first. Coming into care is not one of those things that's high on your list. Financial barriers. HIV is an expensive disease. And the Ryan White program does provide care regardless of the ability to pay, but that means that you have to get into care before you find that out. So if you don't have money, then oftentimes you don't come into care. I don't remember what, I don't know whether it was Shannon or Greg that mentioned this morning that there's a lack of information. The number of people who know about HIV has decreased in recent years instead of increased. So if you don't know about HIV, you don't know you're positive, then coming into care is not something that is on your radar screen. Mental health and substance abuse issues, dealing with that first is sometimes a challenge that people have, and so they don't come into care. And also there's still mistrust of the healthcare system. So why come into care in a system that you don't trust? So those are just some of the issues that we have found. So there's a lot for us to work on in trying to address what we know are some of those barriers that are out there for people to access care.
Great. And thinking about the issues that you've identified, I want to turn to Dr. Graham to talk specifically about how the Office of Minority Health is focusing on these issues, and very specifically how the national plan that you all have developed is helping us to aggressively address issues of disparities in the African American community, and specifically with regard to African American men.
Great. Thank you very much, Melly. First, I want to start off by saying this is a great day. The fact that we're here having this conversation means a lot to me, both personally and professionally. When I was in medical school, one of the first diagnoses I gave was to a young man who looked just like me. We're actually about the very same age, and I felt like I was looking into the mirror in terms of just articulating the challenges he was facing, and then giving him that diagnosis was one of the most life-changing experiences for me. And then goes back to the point that Shannon made earlier, that the face of HIV/AIDS in the African-American community is multifactorial. And though I'm going to talk about specific communities that we're targeting, it's important to understand that we need to remove stigma and be able to deal with all the different shades and dynamics that face this particular epidemic. So I want to talk about two things in terms of the Office of Minority Health and certainly the HHS perspective. This is a high priority for our department, and certainly will continue to be a high priority for our department. From our perspective, we have been targeting specific subsegments of that community that we think require special attention. One being the ex-offender population. As Greg articulated very well to you, this idea of how African-American men cycle in and out of the penal system is important for a number of different social reasons, but also in terms of its impact on the epidemic, an impact in terms of the rising HIV/AIDS rate within the African-American male community is particularly important. So last year, we launched a specific program, the Health Improvement for Reincarcerated and Ex-Offender Males initiative, directed specifically at African-American men who had either recently been incarcerated or currently were incarcerated. Many of these men, when they get released from prison aren't connected to care. They're just released from prison. So we started working with grantees to work with these men to make sure that when they're in prison, they start being connected with care. And certainly soon after being released from prison, that they're connected with care from the state to the federal level. Some interesting things have happened with our grantees. And it's interesting to understand some of the dynamics in terms of awareness. So one of our grantees working with the Otisville incarceration facility, they actually organized a national HIV/AIDS walk on December 1st and raised about $240 from half of the inmates within the prison to donate towards HIV/AIDS efforts. So why is that interesting? Because inmates make about 25 cents per day. So these men were stepping up to the plate to donate what little they could do in terms of their own personal effort towards trying to stem this epidemic. So I'll tell you that when you engage men, especially African-American men, when you engage them, they want to be engaged. It's just about making sure that we engage them appropriately in the right environment and in a culturally specific way so that they can feel that they're a part of this effort. And certainly, I think, Shannon, your comments were well worded this morning. Our national plan, to give you just a one-second background, the Office of Minority Health has started on an effort to have a national health disparities plan. The idea here is that we've never had a national plan to address health disparities in all this variety of different forms, whether we're talking about obesity, diabetes, cancer, and all the various disease entities that disproportionately affect minority communities. The goal of this plan is to create effective partnerships at the grassroots level and connect them to partnerships at the federal level, from the treetops to the grassroots, to deal with health disparities. As was articulated before, issues resulting in health disparities don't result from one single act, and certainly there won't be one silver bullet that will help deal with all these various health disparities that disproportionately affect minority populations. Certainly HIV/AIDS is embedded within our overall strategy. We want to make sure that we build partnerships from the treetops to the grassroots, from the one-foot level to the 100,000-foot level, to make sure that people understand that we need to work on these things together. So what we've learned from building our national plan, in addition to some of our grants efforts that I was just articulating earlier, is that community engagement is the key. The multifaceted nature of these challenges are going to require multifaceted responses, and the response needs to be a strong federal government response, it needs to be a strong state government response, it needs to be a strong local government infrastructure response, but it certainly is going to require engagement and response from the community as well, whether we're talking about the business community, whether we're talking about the faith community, whether we're talking about all those different partners that help make up the broad diaspora of the communities that we live in, and certainly dealing with HIV/AIDS is going to require that as well.
Great. Thank you. And several people on the panel, and I actually before the panel, we keep turning back to Shannon, why these things all tie together, have raised the issue of men in prisons and incarceration rates. And given your expertise, Dr. Kendig, I want to ask you kind of a baseline question about the HIV rates for men in prison and whether or not most men are infected before they come to prison or once they get in prison, and how that affects the kind of research and care that's needed.
I think the data that is available from the states and certainly in the Federal Bureau of Prisons would indicate that the vast majority of inmates are infected at the time of incarceration. Mm-hmm. A large number of inmates entering the criminal justice system, as I think everyone is aware, do have histories of substance abuse, and a significant percentage of those have histories of injection drug use, which is the leading risk factor for HIV infection. In our system, we have not seen a significant evidence at all of seroconversions of transmission within our system. There was data presented earlier from Georgia, so certainly transmission can occur, but it's certainly at very low rates from any of the seroconversion data that we have, and also from our clinical experience. We've really been focusing on testing and treating. For many of our patients, it's the first time that they've been diagnosed with HIV infection. It is a controlled environment. It is an opportunity for them to get under treatment and care. And so we really have been placing our emphasis on providing testing availability to all inmates as they enter our system. The Correctional Officer Safety Act of 1998 is what is currently in our policy. That only requires the Bureau of Prisons to test inmates who are sentenced for 6 months or more or have risk factors for HIV infection. but with the guidance from the Centers for Disease Control to adopt universal testing across the United States, we have put out direction to test all inmates entering our system, and it is in our preventative health guidelines to do so.
Great. And to draw you back in, Dr. Fenton, and looking at the kind of prevention research that's already underway, if you could tell us more about what's happening for with regard to research for both gay and straight African-American men.
So clearly, as we are looking at scaling up a response to HIV among black men, we have to have a comprehensive approach, which includes policy, program, and research. And the way we are conceptualizing our research is really looking at the nodes of transmission within the community and ensuring that we are looking at individual level interventions. So research which is looking at understanding how the disease is being transmitted at the local level by individual behaviors. Understanding what's happening within partnerships, understanding what's happening within communities, and then looking at the society as a whole. So a comprehensive research prevention strategy really focuses on our efforts in all of those four layers. So for example, at the individual level, as many of you know, CDC has invested a lot of research monies into identifying effective behavioral interventions that can be applied at the local level to reduce risk behaviors, to reduce the risk of STD acquisition and HIV incidence. Some of these interventions have been packaged and are delivered at the local level in a program that we call the DEBI program. And this ensures that community-based organizations, state and local health departments, have these interventions which are packaged and can be delivered to communities and individuals to help to change risk behaviors. For partnerships, CDC's research has really focused on ways in which we can support couples to both be aware of their HIV status as well as to reduce the risk of transmission within relationships. We have done research looking at effective ways of doing partner notification and disclosure of HIV status, both of which have been shown to reduce the risk of onward HIV transmission. And again, through these research projects, we're able to identify and package effective interventions that can then be rolled out. At the community and the societal level, I think this is an area where we need to do a lot more work and research, and certainly CDC alone cannot do this. We need to have our partners at the NIH and other federal agencies, as well as other academic institutions, really building up the research portfolio for the community and the societal interventions. And what do I mean here? We need to understand more effectively the social and structural barriers to prevention, as well as the social and structural drivers for HIV transmission within the community. What is the link between homophobia, for example, and increased HIV incidence? What is the link between the high rates of incarceration and what interventions can be put in place to support our colleagues in the correctional setting to look at effective interventions to reduce HIV incidence? So a lot of our research at the community or social level is already looking at the social and structural factors which are driving HIV. And CDC has certainly been investing in this, and we have identified interventions, for example, focusing on economic interventions, which are really looking at microfinance initiatives and looking at the role of economic interventions to reduce HIV incidence. We've looked at research understanding homophobia and its relationship to HIV incidence and risk behaviors. So again, a comprehensive approach to looking at research for HIV.
That's great. This is what I want to do, because I know we're off time a little bit, but I definitely want to make sure that we have time for you all to ask questions. I have a lot, many, many more questions I could ask. I'm going to ask one more question, but I want to give you all a heads up so you can start thinking about the questions you want to ask, and then I can throw in a few more of mine if you all of a sudden become shy, which I am doubting seriously. I'll ask this one. Given the work that all of you all are doing, we've talked some about research. There's certainly a lot more we could talk about with regard to care. You've talked about the necessity of confronting this issue on every level, and we've also talked a little bit about specific communities. But where do you see the gaps on the federal level? Where do we need to do an additional push, particularly as we're thinking about our strategy and the implementation work that's to come? And I open that to the panel as a whole.
Sure, I'll go ahead and get started. I think one of the things that many of the folks in the community would recognize it is hard to see the interconnectivity of federal efforts. We need to work to make sure that we do a better job at connecting federal efforts across the board, not so much, again, at a 10,000-foot level, but in the community where people are able to see just how much. There certainly is a lot of passion in the federal government, and you can see that represented here in terms of some of the individuals and other folks who are in the audience. But we need to have that translate down into some very integrated community efforts, and certainly working at better integration in terms of federal efforts at the community level is one of those gaps that I think we need to continue to do a better job at doing.
I would agree with that, and I would also say that we need to understand that it is not a monolithic community that we're dealing with, even if we're talking about African Americans. As Dr. Hayter pointed out, and we keep referring to that wonderful presentation that you did, there are subpopulations, and we need to have interventions or outreach strategies to get people into care that are targeted specifically to the specific population that we're trying to reach. So for African American men that are men who have sex with men, or African American men that are heterosexual men, they may look the same, but you may have to have very different strategies to address them, to get them to test, get them into care, and retain them in care. So that's something that, you know, we have our research, and we need to translate that better to get the information out to our grantees to say that just because something worked in Washington, D.C., a big small town or something, it may not work. It may work very well in Cincinnati. It may not work at all in Montgomery, Alabama. So targeting various interventions that we know that work, that you talked about the Debbies, targeting them to the specific population so that we can better address this epidemic, I think is something that we need to work on.
I think we're seeing more funding for incarcerated populations who are being released to the community from NIDA and the CDC and HRSA, and I think the reentry part for us is such a huge challenge because we can make the diagnosis and start inmates on treatment and have had good results getting good viral load suppression, but that reentry time is just such a very fragile time for inmates, and there's so much on their plates. And taking their antiretroviral therapy may not be number one. You have concerns about relapse. You have just getting housing. You have vocational concerns. So all of that, I think, is a huge challenge. And for us, where we send inmates throughout the country from 115 different prisons, having the partnerships with our federal OPTIVs to help with that is very much needed and appreciated.
And just to say, I agree with what everybody has said. I think if I think of areas that we should really be strengthening our work, in addition to what colleagues have said, we need a balanced portfolio of prevention interventions. So to move beyond the individual, to look at the community and the societal, ensuring that we are combining these interventions appropriately across the country and targeting the interventions where they're needed best. So I think if we look at our prevention portfolio, there is a paucity of interventions that we are delivering with communities or at the societal level, and that really needs to be addressed as we move forward.
Thank you. Well, do we have questions from the audience? If you could give me your name and whatever organization you might be with, that would be helpful. And I don't know, do we have microphones or just... Okay, actually, if you could come over to the microphone, sorry about that, that would be terrific. And that way everyone could hear you. So there's one on each of the outside aisles.
Hi, I'm Lisa Fitzpatrick from Howard University, and I have many questions, but I will show restraint and only ask one. My question is for Mr. Kindig. I was curious to hear a little bit more about the policies regarding HIV testing in prisons. You mentioned that there's little evidence to support seroconversion happening in prison. So what are the policies associated with testing inmates when they exit?
We've not supported testing upon exit. We really feel we used to do that in the federal government. It used to be our policy. That was discontinued many years ago. We think that the time to test inmates is upon entry, and if they do not want to be tested at that time, to continue to offer it through routine chronic care and preventative health visits, so that we can identify inmates who need to be on treatment, and that is the vast majority of our patients with HIV.
Thank you.
Hi,
go here.
Hello? This
yes.
one? Okay. Hi. My question sort of ties
Could you give us your name and organization?
I'm sorry. No Ron
problem.
Simmons with Us Over Guns, People in Living in Washington, D.C. We are an AIDS organization in Washington, D.C. My question sort of follows up with her and that with hers is that if you say that you know the transmission that's happening in prison, I guess the best way to know would be to test everyone when they come in and test everyone when they go out and see was there a difference between those who came in negative but not positive. And to me, to like avoid that is really a way of not dealing with the issue of transmission in prison.
We did report on several years ago, we followed 4,000 inmates who came into our system for 2 years, and we serially tested them. And we had one inmate convert out of those 4,000 inmates. And our clinical experience is we are not having inmates that present with AIDS who have not been tested in our system or have been tested and negative and now are positive. So we are not seeing high rates of seroconversion. Our argument about repeating testing on the way out has really been that we want to focus our resources on the reentry process and not to be retesting tens of thousands of inmates. I really think with limited resource, you put your efforts in the front end to identify patients early on and get them on treatment.
Great, thank you.
Keith Rawlings, Dallas, Texas. One of the recurring themes that all of you have mentioned is that you are linking people to care, whether or not that is from a prevention and getting them into intervention or at the level of HRSA providing ongoing care or reentry. One of the bigger problems, however, is that there's been a pretty continuous decline in the number of available HIV providers around the country, and particularly that has been magnified in communities of color and in poor communities. And while this may be an issue that primarily falls to HRSA with the Ryan White Care Act, what are the efforts at the federal level across all of your programs in terms of dealing with the workforce problems that we are now seeing in many of these communities? Reentry populations who can't find a provider even though they were started on care. Populations in smaller communities who are getting great efforts around prevention and testing but then can't find anybody who is going to take care of them. And I'm curious from a federal and from a national AIDS policy level, how are we going to address that part of the initiative since we have mostly been seeing a decline in that workforce?
That's a great question. Since you mentioned HRSA, I will take the first stab at an answer. There is a recognition that there is a shortage of primary care providers in this country to take care of people with diabetes, hypertension, HIV. And so there is a concerted effort to increase the number of National Service Corps scholarships. For example, that program has expanded under ARRA as well as under healthcare reform efforts. So there will be more primary care providers that are given scholarships to actually go to medical school. But also, in order to get people into communities quickly to provide care, there's an expansion of the loan repayment program. So if you have already gone to school and finished your internship and residency and have medical school debt, then the federal government will pay that debt as you work if you agree to work in an underserved community. So those programs have been expanded as well as many of the other health professions training programs in HRSA. So I am aware of that. We also have an initiative looking at the HIV workforce, but that is folded in as part of the larger primary care workforce because we know that just because you graduate and are out working doesn't necessarily mean that you want to take care of or are feel equipped to take care of people with HIV. So through our AIDS education and training centers, we continue to provide training for clinicians who are already out there that are not necessarily providing HIV care. For example, in our community health centers, they've had a big expansion in the last few years. That's where care is happening. So we want to make sure that we increase the number of providers in community health centers that are capable of and willing to provide care for people with HIV. So through our AIDS ETCs, AIDS Education and Training Centers, we are educating more providers in community health centers, and we hope to expand that as well.
And I would just add to that that this is an issue that the president has underscored for all of the senior staff, and it is of primary importance to him. It's something, as Dr. Parham was saying, is definitely a part of the healthcare reform effort, and we believe that effort will have substantial benefits for those who have been infected with HIV/AIDS, as well as trying to prevent people from becoming infected along with the National AIDS Strategy. But this is something that we're focusing on. I mean, to the degree there is a memo sitting on my desk that I have until 4 p.m. today to comment on, as my colleagues and I are confronting this issue. So it's something that we recognize is an issue, and we want to work to try and address and to get ahead of it as the rest of the nation is starting to absorb the benefits of healthcare reform. I'm going to go to the next question. I'm also going to ask my colleague, Greg Millett, to come forward. I have to jump on a conference call that started about 5 minutes ago, but we will continue with your questions. And I want to thank you again for being here and for participating in this conversation.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ernest Hopkins, and I'm with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. It gives me an opportunity, now that Greg has officially taken a seat on the panel, to thank him so much for all the hard work to get this meeting together, and thank Jeff's office generally for the time and attention that is being shown to black men today. I want to follow up a little bit on the workforce issue, but speak more broadly about what I believe is at least as challenging a concern for the black community writ large. And I'm going to speak specifically, or my remarks will be specifically around black gay men, but you could speak, it could hold true for the entire black community. And it's around the infrastructure that we will have in place to provide health care for HIV prevention, for treatment, for our social services. You know, it is 30 years into the epidemic, and we are 20 years into Ryan White, and there's a significant amount of healthcare infrastructure that has been paid for over time, both on the prevention side and the care side, through community-based organizations. But when I look across the country at the community-based organizations that are indigenous to the black community, there are very few of them that have solid healthcare infrastructures that can provide basic primary care, that have the HIV expertise to provide the kinds of HIV care that we know is going to be increasingly necessary now that we are marrying so significantly HIV treatment with prevention. And so I really am challenged to know, and I really mean this question respectfully, but it is a challenge that I continue to face, where I don't really see the commitment from the federal government over time to nurture and sustain black infrastructure. We see scattershot funding that is put into the community for a few years, then it goes away. Those organizations are never, in my opinion, trained on how to, in fact, use those federal dollars for the time that they have them to actually accrue other dollars to bolster their infrastructure. And so what you have is sort of these kinds of peaks and valleys that occur over time without a solid infrastructure being developed over time. And I'm fearful that with the new healthcare reform coming into place, that what we will see is many of our indigenous community-based organizations not being able to respond appropriately to the many new methods of payment, of service delivery, that the new structures will require. And so, really and truly, I'm interested in knowing from both HRSA and the CDC, and especially from the Office of Minority Health, what you envision for the next, you know, cycle or two with regard to healthcare infrastructure and capacity building for black community organizations, and specifically for black gay organizations.
Great question. Can I take that first? Mm-hmm. So I think your question articulated better than I did what I think are some of the challenges in terms of federal funding and trying to make that connectivity in terms of grassroots organizations that we all know to be primarily even sometimes more effective than the federal government in terms of being able to deliver messaging as well as deliver services. So for years, we have specifically targeted a lot of our funding to specific community-based organizations to fill in the gaps where they might not traditionally be able to access federal funds in different areas. And that's something that's been a discrete priority for myself as well as other folks who work with us in terms of grant programming. But that, again, remains a very dynamic challenge. And I think part of the, and we have to be very transparent and upfront about this, I mean, part of the challenge is organizations sometimes aren't, sometimes lack the capacity to be able to apply for the funds, even when we try and make it explicitly available. And part of the problem is they're all doing good work. So they don't necessarily have the time to be sitting and going through all of the necessary grant criteria in a way that then makes them more competitive. And we've tried to work hard on that. I think we've had varying successes in some areas, especially with our community-based funding that we have tried to really push down to the grassroots level. We've had some successes, and I think across the board, though, we still continue to see those challenges. Your question really goes to what does it mean for the future, and I'll tell you that from the HHS perspective, certainly at the highest levels of HHS, if you look at a lot of the wording from funds that have come out of our, from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Funds, as well as a lot of the wording of health reform, there is the recurrent theme of community, the recurrent theme of trying to make prevention as community-based as possible. So there is that vision to try and be able to connect communities, African-American communities in particular are important, especially in the context of this discussion, also African-American organizations that service the community writ large, but also those folks that can reach into populations such as the African-American gay population and other similar kinds of populations that we know need to be reached are particularly important for us from the federal level. So I think you see that wording within various parts of the health reform law. I think an implementation side is certainly something that's very important to us, and OMH is at the table on a number of various implementation type activities. And what we hope is to get your ongoing feedback as we go forward with the process. What I mean by that is feel free to say, you know what, it's not working. And feel free to articulate, just as you just did, that what we're saying isn't what's happening, so that we can know what we need to improve on the front end as we move forward. It's certainly a priority, and I'll tell you that it's an ongoing challenge, as it has been for years.
Yeah, I'll speak to that as well. Thank you, Garth, for that explanation. Within HRSA, our programs are care and treatment programs. And a few years ago, we had a concentrated effort to expand the care and treatment sites, and we did that through planning grants. So we gave the planning grants out, but you don't plan just to plan. You plan to provide care and treatment. And a number of those programs did graduate, and we were able to give them funds to sustain them. Those programs are still ongoing today. Going forward, one of the things that we see is not a huge expansion of Ryan White programs, but within HRSA, the big expansion for care and treatment of anyone has come through the Community Health Center program. So as one of the things that we're having discussions about internally is there a way that we can encourage those Ryan White grantees or those that look to the federal government for care and treatment dollars through Ryan White, are there ways that they can look to other sources of funding? I think it's incumbent upon us at HRSA to push it both ways, me in the Ryan White program to make sure that people know there are other sources of funds available and this is how you access them. And then in the community health centers, when they're looking in their community and doing needs assessment about who is in their community, who needs care, who's not coming into care in our site, how can they expand as well? So there, it's not just the Ryan White or those traditional HIV AIDS care providing organizations that have a responsibility to provide care for people with HIV.
And then finally, just from the prevention side, Ernest, you know I share these concerns, and you and I have had many conversations about the real dearth in capacity that we see, especially when it comes to organizations which are serving Black gay men, and what our strategy should be nationally in building that capacity moving forward. We are committed as an agency to continuing our community-based organization funding and support. That has never been on the table, and it will never be on the table. What we have to do is to ensure that the funding and the accountability evolves over time. We are restricted because of our funding cycles, so we have to go through the 5-year funding cycles for the CBO program. But what we attempt to do within that is to ensure that we provide the capacity building to the organization so they can compete very well in subsequent funding cycles. And we have seen over time an increase in the proportion of CBOs that have success in gaining funds in the subsequent funding cycles. So we see this as a good thing. Moving forward, however, in addition to what you've heard from everyone else, I think there are some key things that we need to be focusing on. First of all, how do we continue to evolve the role of community-based organizations to be a part of the prevention portfolio? What is the unique role in the era of health reform, in the era of increased community health centers becoming available? How do we uniquely position the community-based organizations? Second, how do we do a better job in identifying the gaps in service provision and position the CBOs to better meet those gaps? Thirdly, how do we have much more robust capacity building assistance for the CBOs so that we are ensuring that over time, over the 5-year funding cycle, that we're actually building that strength? And then finally, how do we look beyond just the HIV-funded community-based organizations? The reality is that there are perhaps many more CBOs that focus on health within the Black community. And I would argue that we're not leveraging those community-based organizations in a way that we should. Now, some would argue that there are risks in doing that because some of these non-HIV CBOs may not be culturally competent to deal with some of the issues for HIV. But unless we begin to think more creatively, we will continue to have real capacity issues within the community. And as you are very much aware in the recent CBO announcement and in previous CBO announcements, in some of the highest risk areas or the high incidence areas across the country, CDC can only fund 1, maximum 2 community-based organizations. That's not going to help us to get beyond the curve. So we need to look beyond our HIV-funded CBOs, to look at other health directed CBOs, and to look at capacity writ large, and to engage a wider cross-section of organizations in the community. And again, we're committed to doing that.
Unfortunately, we are a little bit past time, so if we could just limit it to the last three, or the first three questions, and we can continue with the next panel.
Okay. Patrick Packer with the Southern AIDS Coalition. And I want to thank you all for all the work that you're currently doing in to address this issue in the African-American community. But there are serious geographical disparities, whether it's around new infections or providers of care, prevention dollars, across the board, even across incarceration issues. So I'm curious to know what specific things are you all planning in the near future to address the geographical disparities. We see that foundations have stepped up in the private sector to allocate resources. Pleased that the Ford Foundation has been one of those organizations to do that. So I was curious as to know, you know, around funding issues specifically, what are you all planning to do to address the geographical disparities?
So I'll just jump in. We are very much aware of the geographic disparities, and we've had many conversations with our colleagues in the South about thinking critically about a Southern strategy when it comes to HIV prevention. And there are three key strategies that we use at CDC. So first is classifying and characterizing the epidemic in a much more robust and a much more sensitive way to better understand the drivers for the epidemic in the South. The second is really looking at our funding more critically and ensuring that we use funding priorities which take into consideration the changing epidemiologic profile in the South. And many of our recent funding announcements, for example, our expanded HIV testing initiative from CDC, really looks at areas which are hardest hit by HIV, especially among African Americans. And we disproportionately allocate funding to jurisdictions, many of which are in the southeastern parts of the United States, and target those jurisdictions for funding. So we can use the epidemic profile to dictate where we're going to be differentially investing our HIV prevention resources. And then thirdly, we need to think about the social and structural interventions and activities that really can help to support our prevention interventions in the South. We know that in many Southern states, the policy environment, the social environment, and the structural environments are not conducive for effective HIV prevention programming. So we need to work with our community partners, with our partners in the state and local governments, with our partners in the business sector to really think about what are the social and structural interventions that we need to put in place, especially in the parts of the South, to ensure that we are maximizing our prevention opportunities. So we're very concerned about the South, and these are some of the things that we're doing at CDC to ensure that we have a more targeted approach to prevention.
Thank you, Kevin. We have time for two more questions.
Hello, my name is Court Jefferson, and I'm the Washington reporter for TheRoot.com. And my question is that more than three quarters of the African American population self-identifying as Christians, and a whole host of others self-identifying as Muslim, frequently I think issues of homophobia in the black community are a matter of people's very deepest beliefs. And I'm wondering if there's anything that you guys think we can do with this sort of community-based funding to sort of help shift the dialogue that's often coming out of churches and mosques, help sort of change the idea that gays need to be rejected and occasionally sometimes hated outright, and sort of how we can help transition that with community-based funding, if at all.
So I would say that you raise an interesting part of the discussion that we do need to face in terms of issues around stigma. I'll say, though, that recently we've seen a number of black churches in particular embrace a discussion around HIV/AIDS and certainly try and make sure that they articulate to their congregation some of the things that they think that the church can do to move forward. But there's still a lot more that needs to be done. And I think what you were talking about is across the board, how do we start to engage faith-based institutions and faith leaders? And that's going to require some things from our end. It's going to require some things from your end as well. And I think part of what we've learned is many faith leaders actually do want to be engaged in this discussion, and they do want to take on a leadership role in discussion. And I think what it is trying to make sure that we find the right bridge in terms of where the epidemic is, where the community is, where the faith institutions are in terms of their role in leadership, and then create a cohesive message that helps to decrease the conversation, move the conversation away from stigma entirely, and start to move the conversation more towards change and how do we actually change behaviors in terms of behaviors that emphasize prevention.
I want to thank you for that question. In addition to, we must remember that there are faith leaders who have stepped up to the plate and are doing amazing work in changing the discourse within faith communities. We work with faith leaders from across the board in advancing HIV prevention messages and challenging stigma at its grassroots. I also believe, however, that if we are going to have a comprehensive response to HIV in the black community, it's not just the responsibility of our black faith leaders. We need to look at the pillars of the African American community and ensuring that we're having these conversations with black businesses, with black historical colleges and universities, with black entertainment, movie stars, pillars and leaders within the community, so that we have a true comprehensive response to tackling the stigma, which we heard about this morning, within the black community. Too often, I think we are laying the blame of the stigma at just the feet of the faith community, when we have to see that this is a community issue and it needs a community-wide response. So just to say that, I would look even more comprehensively at the pillars in the African-American community.
Great. My name is Darrell Wheeler, Hunter College School of Social Work, City University of New York. I'll blend a question and a comment. With regards to creating, looking at your grant criteria and how those may promote or lessen competitiveness, how are you each, within your areas, looking internally at how those grant-making criteria might not be giving you the return on investment that you might hope to achieve, given where we are in the epidemic 30 years out? And two areas that I would offer in terms of our gaps in thinking about that, one is in the area of structural interventions and how our focus on structural interventions actually focus on accommodation at the end of people already being in the problem situation and not on prevention. And if we use criminal justice as a prime example, we know that there are certain areas that are geographically targeted for introduction of youth into criminal justice systems as opposed to waiting until they're already in the system and HIV positive. And then another is with regards to prevention intervention portfolios that we use. We don't really have a dynamic and forward-thinking agenda where we almost treat our behavioral and social interventions as one-shot deals, and we really have to have a more dynamic developmental orientation, which I would offer as a critical gap in the current portfolio.
So thank you so much for that. I agree with what you've just said. I think there are key issues that we're doing at CDC to really think about how we hold ourselves accountable, as well as hold our partners accountable for delivering more effective and impactful interventions. And I think there's a lens that we are increasingly coming into at CDC, which is understanding both the nature of the local epidemics and ensuring that we are characterizing epidemics appropriately and therefore targeting the interventions to deal with the epidemic at hand. And you heard that very eloquently from Dr. Hayder this morning. Secondly, encouraging our partners to choose the interventions which are likely to have the maximum effect for the population that we're targeting. I think gone are the days when we're selecting interventions which are not going to be as impactful. We now have a very robust toolkit, prevention toolkit, and it is our responsibility to ensure that we're choosing the appropriate interventions for the appropriate epidemics. Third, part of our accountability is ensuring that as we select our interventions, that we're selecting interventions that can be brought to scale. Again, in the era of very limited resources, we do not have the luxury of choosing interventions which cannot be brought to scale to have an impact on the epidemic. And then finally, when we think about strengthening accountability, we need to again create the policy environment, the structural context, which is supportive of these interventions that we're targeting and scaling up. And we have seen over the past 30 years too many examples where our political colleagues or our partners within the community are not supportive of some of the most efficacious interventions, whether it's needle exchange programs, comprehensive sex education in schools, and the list goes on. So I think that we need to think in a very different way when it comes to increasing accountability for HIV prevention, treatment, and care activities, perhaps passing it through this prism of what is the epidemic telling us, what are the best tools to use, how do we scale them up, and then how do we create a context that would be supportive? So, thank you for that.
Please join me in thanking our federal partners for this panel.